So, I'm sorry I'm not doing this in French, but I prepared it in English, so if there's questions in French, I speak French. So I'd like to talk to you today about the emergence and the evolution of systems for transcription in English pronouncing dictionaries. So the basic question is, why did these orthoepists and lexicographers, whose goal ostensibly was to teach a standard and thereby to eliminate variation, actually end up creating systems that work really well for recording variation? And I think the answer lies in their very brand of prescriptivism. I'm going to give you a little bit of historical context before I go into the actual transcription systems. First, in the 17th century, printers began to impose order on a chaotic orthographic field in Britain. Consistency was still a huge problem in spelling at that point, and as the number of works and the sheer volume of books published increased, it became a practical necessity for printers to establish typographical conventions. And it's a case of practical prescriptivism. They established rules because they needed to. And this finally led to the relative stabilization of English orthography. And as spelling stabilized, spelling reform, which until then had been a very important movement in the 16th and 17th centuries, came to be seen as more and more unnecessary, impractical, and it was largely abandoned. At around the same time, at the turn of the 18th century, a number of economic and political factors led to increased contact between people from different parts of Britain and from different social strata. As a consequence, pronunciation became an important marker, or started to become an important marker of social status. And as standards hardened, a new demand arose for manuals teaching correct pronunciation, and a new genre eventually appeared, that of pronouncing dictionaries, which we see therefore have a very prescriptive foundation. Our first look at notational systems is actually before pronouncing dictionaries proper appear in Thomas Dyke's Guide to the English Tongue, which he published in 1707. In it, he adopts a mode of representation that shows a relatively advanced epiphonological analysis of one aspect of English pronunciation, which he shows where closed syllable context entails short vowels. But it's particularly interesting. This is the right side of the screen for you. It's particularly interesting because he has this phonological intuition, but his representation of it is at an intermediate stage between orthography and transcription. He presents the normally spelled word with the conventional word division, and at the same time indicates how it differs from actual realization. Where you see a double accent, it means this is how I would divide the word in spelling, but if you want to say this correctly, you have to get the consonant on the right back and the coda on the left. In 1723, Dyke produced what is commonly considered to be the first pronouncing dictionary, but disappointingly, he included only primary stress in this. The next stage in transcription systems was implemented by Nathan Bailey in the 9th edition of his dictionary. He used stress marks to show, once again, open versus closed syllables, and therefore long versus short vowels. Note that Dyke used superscript accents to mark his stress, but Bailey, even before the 1740 edition, used marks between letters, after the vowel rather than before it, as we would have today before the syllable, the stress mark. And this is what made it possible for him to modify the placement ever so slightly and have it fall sometimes after the following consonant to indicate a closed syllable. Because Bailey provided little in the way of explanation or commentary, it's hard to know whether the typography of his stress mark was his idea or was due to practical considerations on the part of the printer, that perhaps it was easier than having a little superscript mark to actually have it fall between letters. For both Dyke and Bailey, with the simple accent for Dyke and what I call the discriminant accent for Bailey, what can be done to the graphic word is very limited. And this is due to both the fact that following the uniformization of English spelling, a lexical graphocentrism had set in, whereby the written word became identified as the word itself. And the other problem is the fact that their insights remain epiphonological. They are not the heirs of the orthoepists and the spelling reformers of the 16th and 17th century. These men are school teachers who are simply following a pedagogical program. James Buchanan, in 1757, has the same prescriptive pedagogical intentions as Bailey or Dyke, but he explicitly rejects their attempts as inadequate. English pronunciation, he implies, involves more than just knowing which syllable is stressed. The way in which he chooses to annotate words, using predominantly breves and macrons, is the sign of another kind of prescriptivism, a classicist Latin-based prescriptivism. And though Buchanan readily employs an array of diacritic devices, including superscript symbols and different font types, he still does not fundamentally alter the graphic integrity of the word. I call this approach signposting. So this signposting, this realization that a lot of extra information has to be given to render the phonological makeup of a word is part of the Deuxième Révolution de la Grammatisation. And it's definitely a new stage in developing tools to describe language. A system that is both very similar to Buchanan's and drastically different is that of William Kennerick. He also chooses to add diacritic material, but he employs superscript numbers. Kennerick's system can definitely be described as signposting because of this. He keeps the original word and adds diacritics. But he himself did not see it that way. In fact, he was extremely critical of Buchanan's system and accused him of modifying the spelling too much. And I think that perhaps this is because the symbols that Buchanan used are from orthographic traditions. They're not used in English orthographic tradition, but they are orthographic in some languages. And that in Kennerick's mind, this meant that adding them to a word actually changed the orthography of a word, and that this was not a good thing to do. Instead, he has recourse to numerals, and this is symptomatic of the Enlightenment's mild obsession with hard science and mathematical truth, though in this case there may be some confusion as to the prescriptive rather than the predictive value of something erected into scientific law, and in the way that Kennerick's numbers here are meant to be absolute. The first to propose a system that went beyond signposting was Thomas Sheridan. And he actually did so before Kennerick in his 1762 dissertation on the causes of the difficulties which occur in learning the English tongue. In this dissertation, he actually proposed the superscript numbers, but he wanted to use them in a way that was much more radical than Kennerick actually did. Sheridan was the first to fully express the concept of bijectivity, and he actually gives specific rules for how to achieve a bijective system of representation. He says, "No character should be set down in any word which is not pronounced. Every distinct simple sound should have a distinct character to mark it for which it should uniformly stand. The same character should never be set down as the representative of two different sounds. All compound sounds should be marked only by such characters as will naturally and necessarily produce those sounds upon their being pronounced according to their names in the alphabet." So this is a pretty good characterization of bijectivity, except for the reference to the alphabet, which is symptomatic of this problematic relationship to the graphic form. But what's interesting is that his actual transcription system is anything but bijective. There's significant overlap in the proposed notation. I don't know if you can see. In the proposed notation for vowels, for instance, here we have A2 and E2 are the same sound. E3 and I3 are the same sound, and there's several more of these. He's the first to sort of whittle down the consonant system, to really look at consonants and try to simplify them. But he keeps a lot of digraphs to mark them, so it's not bijective in this sense as well, either. The interesting thing, though, is that Sheridan is completely aware that he does not have a bijective system. In fact, he draws attention to the fact that he has duplicates, that he has digraphs. He actually is the one who coined the word digraph in his dictionary because he was annoyed that people confused diphthongs and digraphs. And he draws attention also to the fact that he uses mute E's in his dictionary. He says that it's completely intentional. He explains, the final mute E is always continued and sometimes inserted where it is not in present use, because it is so generally employed in our tongue as a guide to pronunciation that the omission of it might puzzle persons at first sight in the pronunciation of many words where they were accustomed to see it. So basically, the graphocentrism that existed before in its unadulterated form is kind of attenuated here, and it's reinterpreted into a pedagogical consideration. It's an issue of intelligibility for Sheridan, basically. But still, the limit between orthography and transcription is not completely clear. Sheridan's graphocentrism does not include clearly the inviolability of the traditional spelling, or perhaps it does, but he has a clear different category for respellings. And the respellings are now clearly divorced from the lexical identity of the word and from any semantic referent. The respelling is now a purely metalinguistic form. This is especially obvious with the vowels. Sheridan's superscript numbers are not diacritic in the strict sense, but they're used to create new units. A1 in Sheridan's system is not an A with an added one. The A1 taken altogether stands for the cat vowel. So Sheridan uses numbers most probably for the reasons that we mentioned earlier, that it looks scientific, but he uses them to create a new notational system rather than simply to add information to the word. The most advanced of the 18th century transcription systems is without a doubt that created by Thomas Spence in 1775, so earlier than Sheridan, actually. His system is the one that most closely resembles the IPA, and it's also the one that is the only one to be bijective. It's an extended alphabet with additional symbols created on the basis of existing letters. Spence's main strategies to create new letters are ligatures and half letters. But the interesting thing about Spence is that he is the only orthoepist lexicographer to also be a spelling reformer. And this is very unusual for the second half of the 18th century. He published books in his reform spelling, such as here, The History of Crusonia, which was supposed to be a supplement to Robinson Crusoe. And this was actually the extension of his goal to teach. He explicitly says that these books are meant to be more easily accessible to the laborious part of the people. These are meant to be read by people who don't have time. This is he says, for people who don't have time to learn how to read the traditional way. But if you take a clearer look at his spelling, at his use of I's for the I sound, or the Z for in landlords, it depends on the conventions of traditional orthography. And it looks a lot like what you would find in internet chat rooms, or if you Google lolcats, you'll find a lot of this. Spellings that look wrong, but they're really the product of an overwhelmingly literate context where the orthographical conventions have been internalized. So neither Spence nor Sheridan ultimately managed to escape graphocentrism. And the fact that Spence proposes a different system for his dictionary transcriptions and for his actual reform spelling is difficult to understand. There might be condescension in his reform spelling, whereby he thinks that his fully bijective system and completely different system is too hard for some people to understand. Or maybe he's simply conceding that a complete overhaul of spelling is just something that is not going to happen. I'd like to mention here Jeffrey Pullum's proposed principles of prescriptivism, the reasons for and justifications evoked for prescriptivism. He counts 9 of them, and I think that they could be classified as conservative for the first 3 and reformist for the other 6. And these tend to come together. There's different degrees of different types of prescriptivism in almost every instance of prescriptivism. But what's interesting with the orthoepists is that the conservative attitudes get applied to spoken language itself, but the reformist ones revert to their representational system. And what's different about Spence is that he actually has his reformist tendencies applied to his reformed spelling, therefore leaving him free to create a transcription system that's actually really descriptive. So my conclusion is that there are layers of prescriptivism in the transcription systems of these pronouncing dictionaries. There's the right pronunciation, which is the external social pressure that motivated these dictionaries in the first place, that is usage-based and not rule-based. They actually specifically say that rules are absurd. They reject Latin rules as not applicable to English. And the whole point of their dictionaries, even though usage-based prescriptivism can sound like a paradox, the whole point is to be able to give an exhaustive list of examples rather than erect rules to still be able to prescribe the correct to prescribe forms. And so this is the reason for their whole pedagogical endeavor. The second layer of prescriptivism, I think, is graphocentrism. And in the first phase, this means that orthography is actually untouchable. And then it becomes something that can be modified, but it remains a benchmark in a more or less conscious way. And the third layer of prescriptivism is the transcription systems themselves. Because they are the result of prescriptive tendencies also, they become something that they're super critical of each other. And they each think that their model is the only possible model. And Nicolas Ballier in his thesis coined the term mon modèle like Jacques Lacan has la langue to describe the linguistic baggage of an individual. There's the sort of baggage that these orthoepists have as when it comes to their model and what a model is supposed to be like. Thank you.